So we're in the book of Deuteronomy. We did the five W's sometime. I think last week, remember I didn't want to go any further, but we had the test yesterday on Numbers. So, of course, a quick review. We know it was written by Moses. The children of Israel are on the plains of Moab, getting ready to go across the Jordan. And they're going to conquer the promised land and inherit it. But before this happens, Moses has some talks and some things to explain to them. And he's like an elderly father or grandfather talking to the next generation. I shouldn't say he's like that. He actually is that. You know, he's way, way older than most of the people he's talking to. And because God condemned Israel to wander for 40 years and said nobody who's 20 years and older at the time they refused to go into the promised land the first time, none of them are going in. So Moses is talking to a lot of people who are now younger than 40 years old, many of which don't remember the stuff that happened. There are a few. The oldest among them might have walked through the Red Sea as children. You know, might have been born in Egypt, but a large number of them were born while wandering in the promised land. And if you remember in Fundamentals when I was talking about one of the principles of exegesis is to understand what this meant to the people then, and you want to understand the cultural and historical context, this whole cultural and historical context is important to Deuteronomy. And it also will explain why there's so much repetition, at least early on. There are some parts of Deuteronomy where I'm going to want to spend some time and focus, and there are some, like these first chapters, where it's sort of like that throwing a flat stone on the pond and seeing it skip across. We'll be doing some of that. So let me discuss. The first five verses are pretty much an introduction. As I said, the name of the book in the Hebrew is Words, because it says these are the words Moses spoke. Some people even think that these first five verses were an introduction written by someone other than Moses. Some speculate that Joshua wrote it. But there's no evidence for sure of that. There's not any hard reason why Moses couldn't have written it that way. One thing I'd like to point out in verse 2, because now they're on the plains of Moab getting ready to enter the promised land, he mentions it's 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea is not where they are now. That's where they were, where God was originally telling them to enter the promised land. But they didn't because they sent scouts who went and said, oh, we're like grasshoppers. We can't do it. Yes?
Not where Moses, or God told Moses to hit the rock.
Near there, yeah. Matter of fact, I think, yeah, was there. But probably 38 years later than when they didn't enter the promised land. Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai. So, interestingly, just think, 11 days they could have gone from Mount Sinai to the promised land and went in, but instead it's been 40 years. Why? Because of their rebellion, because they didn't have faith in God that they could do it. So, you know, that's what happened, but now we're at the time setting. Notice verse 4, after he had killed Sihon, king of the Amorites. So again, this is after what we pretty much just covered in Numbers. You know, we've conquered the land of Gilead and Bashan, the Transjordan, and we're about to cross the Jordan, so that's where we are. And so Moses sets that up. Of course, in verse 5, on this side of the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses began to explain. Part of how Moses is going to explain is reminding them of how they got here. So verse 6 is going way back, you know, about 39 years. The Lord our God spoke to us in Horeb, another word for Mount Sinai, saying, you've been here long enough. Take your journey and go up to the mountains of Amorites. So, verses 6 through 8 is basically saying, taking us back to after they received the Ten Commandments. You know, so they left Egypt, we know, crossed the Red Sea, went on through the wilderness and came to Mount Sinai. God spoke to them, gave them the Ten Commandments, proposed the covenant. Then they spent about a year building the tabernacle and then getting everybody organized. You know, I want you guys to camp here, you guys here, you know, and all that stuff that I put in charts that I handed out to you. And after that, after they'd been at Mount Sinai about a year, God says, you've been here long enough, head north, you know, go to the promised land. And it seems, You know, now I say it seems because we don't know for sure what God was expecting, but it's presented as though he expected them to enter the promised land at that time. And the idea is, okay, they come up, Kadesh Barnea is down here somewhere, and it seems he intended them at that time to enter from the south and keep going, conquering all of it until they got to the Euphrates River. You know, so in this case, they've circled around Edom and parts of Moab, and they're going to come in from the east, crossing the river. But the original plan, God brought them up to the southern border, and he says, matter of fact, in verse 8, "See, I've given you the land before you. Go in and possess the land." It's like God brings them up to the gate, opens the gate, and says, "Walk on in." But we know what happened. You know, they didn't. But we're not going to go straight to there yet. In verse 9, Moses is going to put something a little bit out of chronological order. Now, because Moses, okay, you know, this is how we got, you know, that happened. But Moses said, "I spoke to you at that time," or "I spoke at that time. I alone am not able to bear you." Moses reminds them he got overwhelmed, and he says, "Look at you, you're as the stars of heaven," he says in verse 10. In one sense, Moses wasn't exaggerating. Now, we know with modern telescopes that there's billions and billions, trillions of stars, but the naked eye at that time, they estimate, might have been able to count 3,000 to 5,000 stars. To me, that number seems low. Maybe they could have seen and counted more. But the children of Israel, if they're a couple million, maybe 3 million, when Moses says, "You're as the stars," he's being more literal than we might think. Okay, and then what he describes next seems to be what we see back in Exodus chapter 18. In Exodus 18, remember Moses' father-in-law, it says, but it might have been brother-in-law, comes, and he sees Moses spending all day with people lined up to see him to get judgments, and he says, "What are you doing? You're going to wear yourself out, and this people with you. Instead of you making all these decisions, set up captains of 10, captains of 50, captains of 100. Let them judge the small matters and bring the big ones to you." That's what we seem to see described here is at verse 15, "I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, made them heads over you, leaders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens." Now, so that's what this seems to describe. I'll mention that some people think that Moses might have also been inferring what was described in Numbers chapter 11. Because earlier Moses is talking about, "Oh, you're so much, I can't bear it." And Numbers 11 was that incident where Moses got fed up. And it's like, "Oh, it's like I'm carrying a crying baby around. I can't do this." He tells God, "If this is what it's going to be like, just kill me." And God says, "Okay, you know, I'll take some of the spirit that's on you and I'll put it on 70 other men." Remember, that's where the story of Eldad and Medad came in. They didn't show up to the meeting, but God still gave them the spirit because he wanted them to have the spirit. So Moses might have had both of these incidents in mind. And I point it out because he's pulling this out of the normal chronological order he had been in. Talked about leaving Mount Sinai, going up, and the incident with the spies. But him appointing captains of thousands, hundreds, fifties happened well before they left Mount Sinai. And then having those 70 men get his spirit, that came well after, you know, after the rebellion, it seems. So Moses is telling them things they need to know, not necessarily starting a story at one point chronologically and progressing through it. But he's setting the stage to remind them of all that happened to get them there in the plains of Moab, ready to enter the promised land. And I feel like I'm spending way more time telling you about this than I need to. When he appoints those leaders, it's worth pointing out some of the standards for judgment that he tells them. In verse 16, he tells them, "Judge righteously between a man and his brother." So that's something. Judge righteously. Verse 17 says, "You shall not show partiality. You'll hear the small as well as the great. Don't be afraid in any man's presence. The judgment is God's." That's a timeless principle. That wasn't just for them at that time. That's something that applies to us anytime we're in a position of judging. And another principle of good government or administration follows. At the end of verse 17, "The case that's too hard for you, bring it to me and I'll hear it." So anytime a problem is too big or above your pay grade, so to speak, Don't be afraid to go upstairs. That's a phrase Mr. Newtzman uses in the camp setting. He says, bring it up the line. And we tell that to our counselors. We tell it to our lead counselors. We tell it to camp directors. Okay, camp directors, you got a lot of responsibility, but there's times you might need to call Mr. Newtzman and or call the church's lawyer. So, you know, or call Mr. Kubik or something like that. Yeah, I remember the first time I was a feast coordinator. Early on, something came up, and I called Mr. Holiday on the phone and said, what am I supposed to do here? So it's, a timeless principle that applies in many settings. Coming back to the narrative, verse 19, so we departed Horeb. Yeah, okay, we left Mount Sinai, went through this terrible wilderness. You saw the mountains of the Amorites. You know, you came up, we were camped at Kadesh Barnea. And in verse 21, we see what God had told them back in chapter 8. Look, the land's before you. Go possess it. And it seems God wanted them to enter the promised land right then. But now we see in verse 22 something that differs a little from the narrative that was described in Numbers 13. So what we're seeing here corresponds with Numbers 13. There it just says Moses appointed 12 spies and sent them in. Here we see that it wasn't Moses' idea originally. Verse 22, it says, every one of you came near to me, said, let's send men before us and let them search out the land. Well, Moses wasn't disappointed with that. Verse 23, the plan pleased me well. And it seems that he took it to God and God, you know, permitted it, perhaps even told him how to do it. So it took man from each tribe. They departed and went up in the mountains. And we know how that story went. So the next several verses, basically Deuteronomy 1, verses 24 all the way through 33, summarize that account that was in Numbers chapters 13 and 14, where those scouts, 12 of them, did go through the land. They cut down a big bunch of grapes and brought it back on a pole, and then they reported. And as we know, 10 of them said, yeah, it's a great land, but it's too powerful for us. We're too small, too weak. They'll eat us up alive. They're like giants and we're like grasshoppers. Joshua and Caleb were the only two of those 12 that said, no, we can do it. Moses reminds them of this. And that, you know, the rebellion was pretty widespread. Matter of fact, if you note in verse 27, say that you complained in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he's brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. That's pretty strong stuff. When you say, oh, God hates us, that's why we're here. You know, if I were God, I could see taking that a little personally, because God isn't a God of hate, he's a God of love. It's worth noting, let me give you a scripture, a reference in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 3, and it's a long passage in Hebrews 3, verses 7 through 19, refers to that incident and sort of symbolizes it to show how mankind has not been ready to go into the kingdom of God. But we understand we all are going to have opportunity to go into the kingdom of God. For some reason, I couldn't get those words out. Coming back to Deuteronomy 1, verses 34 and 36 have God condemning the Israelites. Anyone who is more than 20 years old is going to wander and die in the wilderness before they get to enter. As verse 35 says, surely not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land that I swore to give your fathers. None of them except, you know, Caleb and Joshua. Verse 36 says, except Caleb, he'll see it. Verse 38, it mentions Joshua the son of Nun. He'll go before you. In between there, though, Moses reminds them of his failure. And Moses interjects this. I find it interesting because back in the chronology of Numbers, we know that Moses, the incident where he smote the rock instead of talking to it, that happened considerably later. But Moses reminds them here, apparently, of why he isn't going to get to go in the promised land. And he puts a bit of the blame on the people. So the Lord was angry with me for your sakes. He says, even you, Moses, won't go in there. I know this makes it sound like Moses is being rather vindictive. But I prefer to think of it knowing that, as I said, he's more of a grandfatherly figure and he's been through this and he actually genuinely loved the people of Israel. It might be more of a matter of, okay, they did wrong and were punished. And when I did wrong, I'm punished too. And he of course, him doing wrong was predicated on getting really, really ticked off at the people and letting it come out and not giving God the glory. And by the way, if you want the reference, that was in Numbers 20, verses 10 through 12, when Moses and Aaron took the rod and said, "Here now, you rebels, must we fetch water out of this rock?" Bam, bam, you know, and God did send water out. Give God credit. He backed him up, but he said, "Okay, now come in private." Which reminds us, you know, there's some question of if or when the people knew that Moses and Aaron were punished for that. God might have decided to keep it private, and now Moses is letting them know, look, I'm not going to be able to cross the river, you know, so Joshua is going to be the one that goes and takes you in there. So there does need to be an explanation. You know, Moses has been leading us for 40 years. What, now he's not going to go across when we get to go in? So Moses has to explain. You know, look, I was angry. It was because of, you know, he says your sake, but it's not the you, because most of the people he was angry at aren't around, you know, or a lot of them aren't. And I've got to remember to keep my chronology straight. But at any rate, verses 37 and 38 remind us, and into 39, that, okay, Joshua is going to lead this next generation in. They are going to enter the promised land. And if you like, you can tie that to Numbers 27, verses 15 to 21. Numbers 27, 15 through 21, of course, is where it first comes up. Moses talks to God and says, well, if I'm not going to get to go, don't make them like sheep without a shepherd. Appoint somebody to lead them. And God says, how about Joshua? Well, that's a pretty good idea. Yes. Numbers 27, 15 to 21. And I sure hope that I wrote that down correctly. So, like I said, I'm sort of skimming across without reading too much of chapter 1 here. Verses 40 through 46, Moses reminds, remember, this younger generation of what the older generation had done. After God told them, okay, you're not going to enter the promised land, you're going to go wander for 40 years, remember, a day for a year. Then a bunch of them said, well, no, we'll go in. And let's get our stuff together, and they started heading in, but Moses didn't go in the Ark of the Covenant, and, you know, the Amorites came and chased them away, and, you know, some of them got killed in the process. So, I'm looking for where I'm at here and want to cover on this. So that takes us to the end of the chapter. So, okay, you didn't get to enter the promised land. You weren't successful at going in without God, which seems natural to us. So they wandered in the wilderness. And we'll see as we go into chapter 2, Deuteronomy chapter 2, the first few verses very quickly summarize about 38 years of wandering. Okay, so he doesn't describe the wandering, and nowhere in the Bible really tells us very much about it. You know, some of the incidents of rebellion, like Korah's rebellion, seems to have happened then. What's the other one I'm thinking of? Oh, that's the big one. Yeah, actually, Korah's rebellion and some other things. And then we skip ahead. And it's interesting, at the end of verse 1, the Lord spoke to me as we skirted Mount Seir many days. Many days, meaning about 38 years. And then the Lord spoke to me saying, you've been doing this long enough. Turn northward. Just like he said when it was time to leave Mount Sinai. You've been here long enough. So it's time to go and command the people. Now, this is, it's interesting to me. It might be less so to you. But I've used some of the language that's here in verses 4 through 8 when we were back in Numbers 20. If you remember back in Numbers 20, Moses sent a message to the king of Edom saying, we'd like to pass through your land. Could we please do that? And we'll stay on the highway. We're not going to get in your fields. We won't drink your water unless we pay for it. We saw that. Here is the version where Moses said God told him to do that. And God says in verse 5, don't meddle with them. I will not give you any of their land, not so much as one footstep. So I'm not going to give you a single foot of Edom's land. And we could ask, why? Because I've given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. So we could infer from this, God intended Edom to continue to be a distinct nation and right where it was. His plan for Israel did not include displacing or killing off the nation of Edom. Of course, you know, they're descended from Abraham as well, so that was part of God's plan. Now, I'm going to summarize the next several verses. Verses 9 through 12 tells us about the same thing for Moab. Early on in verse 9, it says, "Do not harass Moab." And later it says, "Because I've given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession." So God intends for Moab to continue as a nation and for it to be on Israel's border. That's not an accident. That was God's plan. He told Moses, look, you can't have any of that land, not a single foot of it. Now, we read, there's a little insert there, sort of parenthetically, that the Moabites had taken land from the Emims, the previous inhabitants, just like the Edomites had taken land from the Horims. Remember, the IMS is plural, or IM would be, but for some reason the King James translators wanted to add another S to that. And he'll mention that the Amorites had later taken some of the land away from Moab, and they don't get that back necessarily. And now skipping ahead to verse 13. "Now rise and cross over the valley Zered." So this is what had happened. "The time we came to Kadesh Barnea, we crossed over the valley Zered, was 38 years until all the generation of the men of war was consumed." So this is a more precise timing of the end of the older generation. God's saying, okay, you know, I said you're not going in until all of that older generation, everyone 20 and older, dies off. Here we see it's coming up. Interestingly, there's no mention here of Balaam or of that temptation by the Midianite and Moabite women that led to 24,000 deaths. That's described in Numbers chapters 21 to 23, but this is where that fits. And it seems that that happened just before the second census. So you have, you know, Numbers gives a more detailed accounting of many things, but while Deuteronomy is a summary, sometimes it includes some specifics that aren't in Numbers. But we see that, okay, by the time of that second census, God might have said, do the census now, and you're going to notice none of that older generation are still alive. And so it's time, you know, to go in. Let me pause. But first, we note in verse 16, verse 16 tells us that. "So it was when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people, the Lord spoke to me. This day you're to cross over at Ar, the boundary of Moab. But, verse 19, when you come near the people of Ammon, don't harass them. Don't meddle them. Same language you use for Edom and Moab. I've given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession." So, again, God says, I want Ammon to be there. They're going to continue a nation. I'm not giving you their land. And as also before, there's a parenthetical statement about how they had taken the land from those giants. We've got various people that are referred to as giants. You had the Anakim, the Horim, the Emim, and my favorites, the Zamzumim. The Zamzumim, it sounds like a Mazda commercial, right? Zamzumim. But how giant they were, we don't know, but you know, there's a description later of Og, and it says I think he was like 9 feet tall. He's like Goliath. And then we'll see a difference. Starting in verse 24, God did not intend for the Amorites to continue as a nation where they were. He's gone out of his way. Say, Edom is okay, leave them alone. Moab's there, you leave them alone. Ammon, leave Ammon alone. Amorites, kick their butts, take their land. That's not God's language, that's mine. But he says in verse 24, "Rise, take your journey, cross over the river Arnon. Look, I've given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to possess it. Engage him in battle. This day I'll begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations." So, you know, God's saying, you're going to take their land. Interestingly, the land that he was speaking of right there was the Transjordan. That gives us a hint that later when Gad and Reuben and half of Manasseh say, hey, can we have this land? It wasn't necessarily a surprise to God. God is saying, you conquer the Amorites there, I'll give you their land. And that's before they're crossing the Jordan. It's worth noting, though, that Moses still practiced the same type of diplomacy. I've got the scriptural reference back in Numbers 21, verses 23 to 26. Moses sent a message to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Please let us pass through on the highway. We won't eat your food, and if we need water, we'll buy it." So he says the same thing, but the Amorites come out with an army and say, "We want to fight." So the Israelites say, "Okay, an army's coming against us, we'll fight." And God had already told him, go ahead and wipe them out. And at verse 34, "We took his cities that time and we utterly destroyed the men, the women, the little ones of every city. We left none remaining." And that was what God commanded them to do. Which seems really harsh to our sensitivities, but we want to understand God had this plan to bring them up in the resurrection. So the men, women, and even children, they'll come back in a much better world and live out their lives. They'll be living in the world that the millennium spent getting ready for. So let's keep that in mind, although I'm still glad I wasn't in the army having to go kill those people. That's not a job I would like. But yeah, I've got a reference about that resurrection. Revelation 20, verses 11 and 12 is just a reminder. You know, the sea will give up the dead, death and hell, all people. I'm skimming not too bad. If anybody has a question, please let me know. But I hope you're saying, well, we just covered this. And I wonder, sometimes Moses, you know, he's recounting this to this generation. And he's talking about the conquest. And then in a little bit, he's going to back way up 40 years and talk about Mount Sinai. But there's a reason. It seems like right now he's talking about the movement and how you traveled from there to get here. Then he'll talk about the organization and the law and why we have that. But we haven't finished the movement and all that first. So Deuteronomy chapter 3, and basically the first 9 verses, 1 through 9, will recount what was described in Numbers 21, verses 33 to 55. So I'm giving you that reference because it wasn't that long ago we went through it. But remember Og, good old Og, the king of Bashan attacked Israel without provocation. So Israel again was attacked by not just Og, one guy, even though he was a big guy, but he came with an army. Israel attacked and again made a complete conquest and exterminated all the people. There's a mention about who and what Og was like all the way down in verse 10. It says, "All the cities of the plain, all Gilead and all of Bashan, as far as Salca, Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og of Bashan. For only Og of Bashan remained of the remnant of the giants." So Og was one of those giants. "Indeed, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. Is it not in Rebah of the people of Ammon? 9 feet is its length and 4 feet, or 4 cubits, nine cubits its length, not 9 feet, and 4 cubits its width." That would make it about 13 and a half feet high and about 13 and a half feet tall, which leads some people to think that Og was somewhere around 11 to 12 feet tall. Think of what kind of contract he could get in the NBA. I mean, you could slam dunk without, you could probably kneel, bend your knees and still do it. Of course, basketball hadn't been invented. One thing I want to mention where it says bedstead of iron, some scholars of Hebrew think that's a mistranslation, and some say it should be coffin of iron, which would be saying that he was buried in Ammon where he died. Because otherwise the question, okay, he's from Bashan, what's his bed doing here? You know, is it in a museum of things that belong to really tall people? Well, that's possible. Not every bedstead is of iron and 13 and a half feet tall or long. But if Bashan was buried and for some reason, I don't know if his people did it or they decided to make an iron coffin and bury him, that's a possibility as well. I'll leave that open, just not knowing for sure. But Moses will go on from there, beginning in verse 12 through several verses, to say, "This land which we possessed, from Aroer to the river, and half the mountains of Gilead and its cities, I gave it to the Reubenites and the Gadites, and then later half of Manasseh." Okay, and Moses will remind all of Israel of the deal. Okay, Reuben, Gad, half of Manasseh. You can have this land, but you got to send your men armed and ready as we cross over the Jordan. You have to fight and make sure everybody else gets their land. I can give you the scriptures where that's referenced. It's in Numbers 32, verses 17 and 18, and also in Numbers 32, verses 29 to 32. Interestingly, well, it's interesting to me. I'm interested in things some people say that's not interesting, but at the time Moses is giving this talk, those people had gone and probably built shelters and places for their cattle and all that and settled, you know, the wives and families there and then come back and they're armed and ready. So back in Numbers 32, they say, look, let us go get things ready. We'll build pens for our cattle and shelters for our wives and our sons and daughters, and then we'll come back and be ready to fight. Now Moses is from the other end of that saying, they have done that. Probably as he's telling it, here are the men. You know, they're armed and they're ready to go. So that's where we're going next. And starting in I wanted to read verse 18. It says, then I commanded you at this time, saying, the Lord has given you this land to possess. All you men of valor shall cross over armed before your brethren, the children of Israel. And they were there, men of valor and armed and ready to do that. Then I wanted to drop down to verse 21, where we'll see some direct encouragement for Joshua. Because Moses is now talking about ready, armed, you're going to go over, you're going to fight some more. Oh, but by the way, I'm not going, you know, meaning Moses. So in verse 21, he says, I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, Joshua, your eyes have seen all that the Lord God has done to these two kings. Remember Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan? So will the Lord do to all the kingdoms through which you pass. You must not fear them, for the Lord your God himself fights for you. That's got to be encouraging, especially coming from Moses. You know, if Moses walked in the classroom and said, Frank, I got a special job for you, and don't be afraid, God himself is going with you, I'd go, yeah, okay, I can do that. You know, I'd be psyched up. I wouldn't need as much coffee that day. One of the reasons I like to stop and emphasize that is it's worthwhile for those of us who are in the younger generation of God's church, and I say those of us, obviously I'm quite a bit older than you, but I've heard stories all my life of what it was like for those when the church was pioneering and first going out on radio country, you know, across the country and on TV, you know, and I wasn't part of that. I came along towards the tail end of it, but God did great things for the work and for the church then. I think we should see that as evidence that he can do great things and will do great things using us. Just the way he's telling Joshua, look what I did with Moses and those other people. Don't be afraid. I can do it with you. I mean, I don't know what opportunities God's going to have for us, but you never know. If, you know, he starts calling a lot of people into the church. You know, some of us, and not all of us are going to be sitting in front of a TV camera reading a script. Probably none of us. But we might have people show up who say, I became convicted of the Sabbath. I want to keep the Sabbath here with you. And they might start asking questions. What does this church believe? Why do we do these things? And hopefully we'll have the courage and the confidence of our belief to share with them and be an entry point for them to start learning more about the truth. You know, God is with us. As it says, you know, you must not fear them, for the Lord God himself fights for you. And he can help do other things besides fight. There's another reference here, and basically the rest of the chapter, Moses, you know, again, is willing to admit, you know, and I'll give him credit, because usually you don't want to say, well, I went and begged to be able to do something, and he said no. You know, it's like if I went upstairs and asked Mr. Cubitt, can we please have a pizza party for ABC? If he said, no, I don't want to hear about that, I probably wouldn't come down and tell you anything about it. But, and of course, this is a totally different kind of matter, but Moses says, he asked God, please let me go in. Yeah, it's going to be great. They're going over. I want to see this special promised land. And it reminds me, wait a minute, Moses was born in Egypt. As much as we study the Bible and we focus on this area, Moses was never there. Moses never went into the promised land, would never visited Jerusalem or Hebron, never saw the Sea of Galilee, none of that. And he wanted to. And God tells him, you know, matter of fact, in verse 28, the Lord was angry with me for your account, on your account. So he reminds him of why he was punished. And the Lord said to me, enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Now, I want to pause because it's easy to say, enough of that. Don't talk to me about this. You know, and think God is angry and just shut up. But I also like to think, you know, Moses and God had a very special relationship. You know, if Abraham was God's friend, I think Moses was, and perhaps more so. And I can almost imagine it like this, like God is saying, look, I don't want to talk about it anymore. You know, it probably hurt God. You know, so I don't imagine him being angry. Enough, don't talk to me. It might be, it's settled. Let's not talk about it anymore. And I've shared the story, you know, it's funny, this is something from my upbringing that I learned from my sister who learned it from my mom. You know, I grew up in a single parent family for most of my life. And, you know, my mom, you know, I think of her as hard and strong because she had to take care of two kids and work a full-time job and all that. And, you know, she didn't let us get away with stuff. She wanted us to learn how to act, so to speak. So she never abused us in any way, but she would spank us. And, you know, I learned from my sister that later sometimes our mom would spank us and make us go to our rooms and we'd be in there crying. What I didn't know is she went to her room and shut the door and she would cry. You know, because she had to punish her children and it really hurt to do that. And I wonder if God felt kind of like that when Moses is saying, please, can I go in? And God said, no, don't talk to me about this anymore. I wonder if God's almost ready to go to his room and cry a little bit. Maybe. Now, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to speak out of turn about God and who he is and what he does. But I don't picture him just being angry and harsh at Moses. That's not what we've seen as we've gone through the Pentateuch and seen this relationship with Moses. And we see what God does say. He said, okay, I can do this for you. You can go to the top of Mount Pisgah and look and see it all. And we'll see that fulfilled at the end of the book. Yeah, Charlie?
Is the reason why God forbade Moses from going into the promised land possibly because he was held to a higher standard? Because we see Israel messed up so many times and God had mercy on them plenty of times. Hmm. The reason why Moses messes up one time and then gets that kind of, like, obviously it's a harsh punishment, is it because he's held to that higher standard?
Possibly. I think that's an interesting idea. We can't know for sure because it doesn't tell us. The only thing it tells us is it's because God, or Moses, didn't honor God, it says. And apparently to give him credit for bringing the water out of the rock. That does seem to be holding Moses to a pretty high standard, but you got a good point. If he has that close a relationship, he has God's spirit, you need to be held to a higher standard when you're in that situation. I would just stop short of saying we know that for certain. But I could see that as a good possibility. Yeah, Matt?
Yeah, I was just thinking along that concept.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there a verse we recently read about it, in Numbers said the Levites will bear the iniquities of Israel?
Yeah, and there's different discussions of what it means, bear the iniquity. But it's sort of the responsibility for sin and for if things aren't done properly. And if you're getting at that, yeah, Moses is responsible if this isn't done properly. And God said, look, take the rod and speak to the rock. And Moses didn't. He didn't speak to the rock. He yelled at the people. He hit the rock. And he said, must we bring water out of this? So it's implied, yeah, Moses didn't honor God. He didn't. And God, when it first happened, said, because you didn't believe me. I don't think there's any doubt that Moses believed that God could bring water out of a rock. But maybe he didn't believe him to do it exactly the way he said. And so, yeah, he's punished. It's worth noting also, Moses is 120 years old. Maybe God was thinking, I don't want to make him immortal. There needs to be a time when I let Moses go to bring him up in the resurrection, and here's the cutoff. You know, I don't know. That's, again, me speculating. So don't mix my speculations with the hard facts that are in the Bible. You know, you might say, yeah, that sounds reasonable, but, you know, we always want to separate what we think it could be from what we know. Okay, so we go on. Chapter 4, because there, you know, at the end of chapter 3 is just this discussion, and Moses is going to get to see the promised land, even if he won't get to go in. But verse 4, we start to turn away from talking about the journey to talking about God's law. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe. So let's talk about what God commanded us and what we've learned. And in verse 2, he adds something. Before I do that, he says, listen to the statutes which I teach you that you may live and go in and possess them. It's vital to not only have God's law, but to do it. Live by all the statutes and judgments. James 1, verses 20 to 24 makes that point. Or we could summarize, faith without works is dead. Knowing the law doesn't matter if you're not doing it. James will say, the demons know. They know God's word and they tremble. But like I said, they don't repent and obey. And it seems that here Moses is just talking about God's law. We understand that Israel was a political unit, and so they were given what we would call a civil law. They were given a ritual law for worship along with things like the Ten Commandments. Moses isn't drawing distinctions. He's just saying, here's the law, do it. And in verse 2, he says, don't add to the word which I command you, nor take from it. And he reminds him, you've seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor. He destroyed the men there who started, remember? Yeah, we're worshiping God, we got our tabernacle, but this cute girl wants me to go worship that God too. Maybe I can do some of both. There's a strong warning against what we call syncretism. And that's not a new term. Syncretism is mixing elements of different religions. Yeah, I can take the festival of the Saturnalia and say it's Jesus' birthday and have a big celebration and I'm honoring Saturn and Jesus or whatever. And I don't mean Saturn the car. They don't make those anymore, do they? So there's a warning. Don't do that. We could say, in a sense, there's also a warning against legalism. Because he says, don't add to the word. Okay, don't work on the Sabbath. Some people would say, you got to make sure you're done working at least by noon on Friday to make sure you don't work on the Sabbath. And I don't know anybody that does that now, but I've heard people leaning that direction. And God will say, no, don't add to the Sabbath. The Sabbath starts at sundown, or there's other ways to do it, to add to. He said, don't add to it, don't take away from it. God's law is holy, it's from Him. I'm looking to see what I want to say. We want to make a point, we can't improve on it. And the fact that mixing false religion with the true religion pretty much is what the hallmark of modern so-called Christianity. And I feel guilty when I say so-called Christianity. We used to say that publicly all the time, and then we said, we don't have to go around insulting people. They consider themselves Christian. We can call them Christian with an understanding that we believe something different than they do. But still, I want to make the point, most churches out there do practice syncretism. But God gives a clear warning not to do that. Moving on in verse 5, surely I've taught you statutes and judgment. So Moses told him, I taught you these things, just as the Lord my God commanded, that you should act according to them and go possess the land. Therefore, be careful to observe them. It's your wisdom, your understanding, in the sight of all the peoples. And it says, they'll say, surely this nation is great and wise. What great nation is there that has God so near? He's making a point, if you live this way, people are going to notice. And that is something worthwhile. God intended Israel, we say, to be a model nation. And if they came in here and everybody lived this way of life, people would have been noticing it from all over the world. One example, remember the Queen of Sheba. When Solomon was reigning and things were as good as they ever got in ancient Israel, she's coming and saying, I got to see about this. Is this guy really that wise? These people that happy? And she got there and said, I wasn't even told the half of it. Look, you guys have it great and all your people are well fed and they're happy and, it's amazing. I would make the point, that could be true for us in some ways. Maybe you get a good, could be whatever job you have now. It could be in your career. If you're living a good life God's way, people notice. You stand out. And hopefully in a good way. The other thing I'll mention about this, the wisdom. It's funny, when I've studied sources outside from outside the church, just by regular biblical scholars, Some who don't believe the Bible was inspired or don't believe in God, they still note that a lot of the features of Israel's law were remarkably enlightened for the time. So much better than most of the other nations at that era. They said, wow, Israel was way ahead of people, and they attribute it to the Israelites coming up with the ideas, but we know it was from God. So it's worth considering that. I want to drop down to verse 9. As a reminder, it's building up 9 through 14. It said, take diligently. Don't forget this. Verse 10, especially when you stood before the Lord your God in Mount Horeb. And Moses reminds them that, and he's telling these people, but really it was mostly their fathers or grandfathers and grandmothers who were at Mount Sinai, who heard God speak. And Moses is saying, this didn't come from me. This law came from God. No man invented it. Which I was just talking about how modern scholars, a lot of them think that. Moses is saying, no. Okay, you heard God speak, so follow it. Teach your people. Verse 12. Let's go to verse 12. He says, and the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but you saw no form. You only heard his voice. It's worth noting, Numbers 12, verses 6 through 8, God says Moses saw the form of God. That was Numbers 12, verses 6 through 8. Also remember Genesis 1:26, where mankind was made in the form and likeness of God. I'm making the point that just because they didn't see a form doesn't mean God didn't have a form. It's just God didn't want them to see it. And he says, because I don't want you to make an idol. I don't want you to make something and say that's me. One other thing we want to point out as we're on this thought, verse 13. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments. He wrote them on tables of stone. But we want to add verse 14. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments that you might observe them. Some Christian churches have said, see, the old covenant was the Ten Commandments. And if the old covenant is done away, the Ten Commandments are done away. And this verse might be, if you took it totally in isolation, might seem to support that, but it's ignoring so much else that's in the Bible. What we understand is that the Ten Commandments are not equal to the Old Covenant. The covenant was an agreement, and at the center of that agreement was the law, God's law, the Ten Commandments. God would later make a new covenant that would also have the law as part of it. The law existed before the covenant and would continue, you know, beyond the covenant. And I'll make note, and I heard the bell, so we'll wrap this up, but Exodus 24, verse 8. Exodus 24, 8 shows that the covenant pertained to all the words that God spoke, including the judgments that are listed in Exodus 21 through 23. So that covenant wasn't just the Ten Commandments, it was all those judgments. Remember Moses went up and God told him all this stuff. Then Moses came back and proposed the covenant to Israel, and they said, yeah, all that the Lord has spoken we'll do. So we want to be clear. Don't let someone tell you, see, the Ten Commandments were the Old Covenant. Old Covenant's done away. No Ten Commandments. That would be false. With that, I'm going to stop.